I can't imagine a better group of people to. Can I take you all home with me to work on this question? Because I'm actually going to put out a question for us to discuss a little bit. Because yesterday when I spoke with John about the talk, he said, you know, the best thing to do is just give a bit, you know, bit of a framework, an overview, you know, about what kind of how you're approaching the new question and the new work, and then put the question on the table and let people kind of hook into it and dig into it and digest it. So, if all goes well, I will speak for about 15 minutes about the work that's covered in the new book, and then turn it over for discussion about this new adventure that I hope we're all going to be involved in shortly. So, let me just talk a little bit about the designing culture, the technological imagination project. The book, which I call a transmedia project, and I'll explain what that means, addresses three main concepts: technological innovation, the technological imagination, and cultural reproduction. And let me define these for you. I define the technological imagination as the quality of mind that enables people to think with technology to transform what is known into what is possible. This imagination is performative. It improvises within constraints to create something new. It is through the exercise of the technological imagination that people engage the materiality of the world to create the conditions for future world-making. In the active engagement between human beings and technological materials, culture too is always reworked. This happens through the development of new narratives, new myths, new rituals, new modes of expression, and new knowledges that make the technological innovations meaningful. As it is engaged in the process of producing innovation, the technological imagination is thus implicated in a complex process of meaning-making, whereby both technology, the world, and culture are created anew. For this reason, throughout the book, I assert that the training of the technological imagination is a cultural imperative of the highest order. To elaborate how culture is reproduced in the process of technological innovation, throughout the book, I focus on the practices of an elite and privileged group of technological makers and creative practitioners, of which I've been a part of, who manifest the technological imagination at work. Designers work the scene of technological emergence. In the process, they hack the present to create the conditions of the future. Throughout the book, I discuss different design projects where the designers explicitly considered issues of culture throughout the design process. I examine how the exercise of the technological imagination reproduces cultural understandings as part of its expressive output. Based on an analysis of how the technological imagination unfolds and changes throughout the designing process, I speculate about what it would take to train imaginations that are as ingenious in creating new cultural possibilities as they are in creating new kinds of technologies and digital applications. The overarching polemic of the book, which I discuss in chapter one, called Culture in the Age of Innovation, asserts that we need to train our technological imaginations to take culture seriously in the process of technological innovation. The training of this imagination is not just the business of engineers and computer scientists. It is the responsibility of educators across the curriculum. In making this argument, I address the interests of different groups of readers. For my colleagues in the humanities, I hope to inspire them to think creatively about technology and the way in which they can serve important cultural objectives. For my colleagues who identify as technologists, such as computer scientists, engineers, interactive media designers, I hope to illuminate how the theoretical frameworks and analytical methods of the humanities can serve as resources for the creation of socially responsible and engaging new technologies. For all my readers, I seek to clarify how cultural questions, issues, and frameworks of analysis continue to have relevance in the age of technological innovation. The aim of the project is to suggest the contours of a creative and productive relationship among humanists, artists, and technologists, where each can appreciate the particular contribution of the other for the education and exercise of the technological imagination that considers questions of culture throughout the process of technological development. At the base, this requires the development of a shared set of understandings about the nature of technology, of the process of technological innovation, and of the relationship of culture and technology more broadly. So in chapter one, what I do is elaborate a framework, a cultural approach to the understanding of technology. I'm not going to get into that now, but that's the kind of opening framing chapter. In chapter two, this is where I actually am very explicit about the throughput of how I got to where I am now based on the early work I did in feminist cultural studies of emergent technology. So my first book was on reproductive technologies, spanning female bodybuilding, cosmetic surgery, reproductive technologies all the way through computer-mediated communication and virtual reality, right when VR was starting to kind of percolate in the popular imagination. And I reflect now on the notion of the technological imagination and how one genders it, which of course it was always gendered, we just didn't recognize it as such. And so this chapter really addresses the relationship between that early work on biological reproductive technologies that connects now to my focus on media technologies as the premier reproductive technologies of our age, and draws on feminist theories of reproduction to understand how all technologies are reproductive technologies. And so the book elaborates what is at the base, a kind of feminist reproductive logic of technology. That's chapter two. Chapter three, the performance of innovation, reflects on my work at Xerox PARC. I left academia and a tenured position to do something really crazy at a very bad time. In 1999, I gave up tenure to go to Silicon Valley to take a job in industry. What was I thinking? I was thinking that I didn't have a very good handle on the future, because 6 months after I got there, the economic downswing started, and I found myself without tenure in a Silicon Valley research center, Xerox PARC, doing something that was life-changing. I joined a group of research scientists to produce a museum exhibit on the future of reading, based on embryonic technologies that were under development at different labs at PARC. I was hired at PARC explicitly to bring a humanistic perspective and a feminist perspective to this group of new technologies. And I reflect on the kind of work of the technological imagination that for this group of people, the eight of us who were working there in this small group called RED, I reflect on how we actively performed innovation much more than we discovered new innovation technologies and so on. I dig down deeper into one of the projects that I was involved with as an interactive media designer information architect. So one of the projects that I worked on when I was at PARC was the creation of a public interactive that was designed to communicate the 25,000-year history of the development of reading, writing, and communication forms. And this was a public interactive designed to communicate a history that belongs to all of us but is none of ours in particular. And here I reflect on the kind of literacy that a designer must always take into consideration when they are designing interactive pieces, and how every instance of design both draws on literacies that are already kind of in circulation and invariably also starts creating the literacies that are going to be required of the future. So this is a chapter in which I contemplate and revisit the kind of the rise of information design, starting with the kind of science technology museum paradigm shifts, the Eames work on Mathematica and so on, and looks in the end to the ethics of designing culture, designing public interactives that of course always reproduce expectations about new literacies. And this is the chapter that kind of finishes the book, where I reflect on the labor, the literal labor in working the paradigm shift that we are all engaged in now. I revisit Henry Jenkins' work on participatory culture and the paradigm shift that he's drawn attention to. And I really call people to the hard work that it takes to work the paradigm shift. Shift work is never easy. You never know when it begins and when it ends. It does require a lot of labor. It requires labor of learning how to read, learning how to write, how to code, how to author, or at least how to engage deeply under the hood with these technological experiences and applications. But it also really involves the labor of doing institution changing and policy changing and broader things. So I'll talk a little bit about that because I think the next project really comes out of this work that I kind of summarize in Working the Paradigm Shift. And then finally, the last chapter, which is kind of a coda, is a chapter that meditates on a question that I get every time, which is, why are you writing a print-based book in this age of digital culture when you're all about the digital and you're an interactivity designer and so on? So I needed to answer that question, and I answered that question in print because, in fact, it was only by demonstrating the limits of what I could do in print to answer that question that I thought I could make my argument. And so the last chapter is shorter, but it reflects on what the work, the labor that the book, the print-based book, will do for me and this project that the other things will not do. Now, there are other pieces to this project. This is why I call it a transmedia book project. In 1995, I produced with a group of incredible colleagues, somebody who was at Spelman College in Atlanta, an interactive multimedia documentary about the UN Conference on Women that was held in Beijing. This was a time when most feminist responses to technology were very knee-jerk and reactionary, that these technologies that were showing up on our desktops were continued to be cast as the master's tools, and we were very influenced by Audre Lorde's work about the kind of patriarchal kind of agendas that were hidden in these tools. And my colleague Mary Hawks and I found ourselves in unusual situations. We were directors of very well-endowed technology labs, vested with the responsibility of creating new educational programs. And what we wanted to do was show how these new technologies could be used to serve feminist ends. The multimedia documentary is called Women of the World Talk Back. It was created, we took it to the NGO, we took an entire kind of NGO delegation of female engineering students to participate. We documented our experiences, we came back. In between the time we left and we came back, the web exploded. This project was designed to be very video and audio heavy, to be designed to disseminate on CD-ROM. Consequently, it was not able to be disseminated on the web. To this day, it has never disseminated other than through this laptop or Mary's laptop. So for the first time, this interactive piece, now 20-some or 15 years after the fact, will circulate. And so in a weird way, the print book becomes the avatar for the digital artifact. And its value now is not because it was a great piece of multimedia work, although I think its design kind of decisions hold up, design decisions that were informed by feminist theory, but it is a historical archive of a thing that is not well archived on the web. If you go back now and try to find anything about the UN Conference on Women, which was, at the time, the largest gathering of women and men in the name of women's rights that we know of on the planet, that archive is gone. It's gone. We can't get to the platform, the draft platform for action and so on. So it's a story also about the way in which what we think to be the most persistent is now among the most ephemeral stuff that we see. Another piece is a reflection on the practices of new media journalism. I did one of the first webcasts, about the fourth webcast ever done for Apple Computer, of the Olympic Games that were held in Atlanta, reflecting on, was it journalism, was it marketing, and all of the kind of push-pull kind of logics of the web at the time. A whole section of the website that now will accompany the book, that will launch very closely with the book launch, will look at this project that we did at PARC. The project was called Experiments in the Future of Reading. I will abbreviate it to XFR. 18 new speculative reading devices that were built on embryonic research devices that were being developed at PARC at the time. This was a museum exhibit that was installed at the San Jose Tech Museum. It then toured for about 3 years at different science technology museums in the country. It was designed to probe in a McLuhan-esque way how we might read in the future, in very wild ways as well as very kind of predictable ways. And we meant them as experiments, really. How is reading going to change in a digital future? Not abandoning the print-based book, but we did rethink the print-based book. Usually I give a lot of examples about this, but I'm not going to do that today. And then the final project, I have a couple new interactives that I'm building. So a new interactive semantic web that remaps the definition of technology in cultural terms in contradiction to the visual thesaurus, which continues to map technology as an instrumental object-based concept. So I'm working on a kind of a new thesaurus that defines technology as a cultural ensemble of practices and so on. So let me talk a little bit about working the paradigm shift and just suggest that there are, you know, I'm revisiting kind of C.P. Snow's, early injuncture to kind of bridge the divide between the two cultures. Except that my argument is that if we continue to see the two cultures as standing on opposite sides of the bridge, it's hopeless. I mean, we've got 50 years. We've tried the bridging. The bridging's not working. We have to do something different, and I think we have to do it at the level of practices. And so what I argue is that if we're going to, because what happens when you're on the bridge metaphor, and one's on one side and one's on the other, it's just remarkable how each side sees the other as hierarchically privileged, right? One has a lot of money, the other one has a lot of freedom, da 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 da. So I think we have to take up Snow's challenge again, but not to build bridges, but to create new frameworks and new institutional places for the development of and practice of multidisciplinary, collaborative, based, technology-based research. And I think this will involve new participants. I continue to be pretty steadfast about involving women and underrepresented participants in the design process and so on. That's a through kind of put line of interest of mine. It also involves making new commitments, and this is where I can't be more adamant with my humanist colleagues. It is hard to do this work. And it requires you to be a learner again in a way that our egos are often hard to take. Like, I confront things, I don't know how to read them. I can't parse them, I don't get the symbols, I don't understand the way the language is being used. And I ask them to understand that it takes a commitment to be a learner again, and to understand that your ego needs to get out of the way in terms of being not the smartest person in the room when you're doing collaborations on this way. But I also will say that to my technologists, to not be so dismissive or presumptive about what they think they know about culture or what they think cultural kinds of questions are. It also involves, and I, again, this is a new commitment, not a new commitment, but an ongoing commitment to the development of collaborative teams. This comes right out of early work in feminist organizing. This is not a new kind of polemic. And here's where I'm of course, running into some the vicissitudes of reality in the university, which it requires new spaces where people can work together on technological things. This means I can't go into an engineer's laboratory and think I'm going to be a kind of native there, because it is their lab. And I understand it's their lab. They're being funded by NSF. Of course it's their lab. Which is why the MacArthur stuff becomes so important, because I think we have to start funding places that are not owned disciplinarily in the way that they have been before, but are from the beginning a territory for people who can come from multiple disciplines. So to this end, here's what I'm in the process of doing, and it's a hard hat area because it is laborious, but that's okay. I needed a new project. The book is done. So there are a couple stakes in the ground for the new MacArthur project. One of the stakes in the ground is that they are really conceptualizing their new grants as participating in distributive research networks. So they get it, that scholarship in a digital age is not going to look like scholarship in an earlier age. It will be scholarship that that is both local and distributed. So we will have a project in Boston, a project in Chicago, a project San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York. And so part of the new grant that I'm working on is understanding the technological infrastructure that's required to support a distributed research network. We've got a lot of concepts out there, co-laboratories, laboratories of collaborators who are all working locally but are kind of using a kind of technological infrastructure. In 2 days, I go to Chicago to work on the portal that will support these new distributive research networks that MacArthur is funding under their new grant project, the Digital Media and Learning. So one of the things I'm building is I will start building a new portal for them that will probably not be research-based. It'll be we're assembling it from things that are already tried and true and tested. Okay, here's another stake in the ground. This is where conceptually it starts getting kind of interesting. I'm not going to go into this exclusively in depth, but the Digital Media and Learning Research Project at MacArthur has a very robust portal. They've been up and running for about 3 years. And to date, they have funded after-school programs, school programs. There's a school program Katie Salins is running in New York that is a charter school that has a game-based curriculum, middle school game-based curriculum. Everything, you know, from PE to social science to literature to art is going to have a game-based, game mechanics kind of curriculum or pedagogy. So MacArthur, after-school programs, school programs. They've got some domestic programs, website developments for digital youth and so on. And they're starting to look at recreational practices, game playing and so on, games for change and so on. There were two missing elements in their portfolio that they knew they needed to address, and that was museums and libraries. So here's the stake in the ground that MacArthur has set. It's very early in their portfolio of projects, but they said, we will make this claim. Learning is changing in a digital age. And here's one claim, that learning happens in a distributed environment. It doesn't happen any one place. Now, that's not so dramatic of a claim, but it does have implications for their portfolio, and it has implications for their development of research networks, and it has implications for the project that I'm working on to design for them right now. So the two pieces that they asked me to put on my kind of agenda to look at was to think about how museums and libraries will function as part of this distributed learning environment. For the first time, thinking as, you know, we just have to come up with a really good exemplar, not to do it for all museums and for all libraries, but really to look at, you know, one example of how learning for a cohort of students, middle school students, K-12, whatever we decide, how they learn in a distributed network. So then here are some of the, this is what's next. So here are some of the kind of commitments and ideas and concepts that I bring forward to this, to this project. So I'm doing a planning grant. The planning grant has a very short lead time. I've got till December to put together a broader proposal. Here's what the stakes in the ground are for me as a kind of local PI of a project who's now trying to make connections with other people. There was some really good, interesting work on the future of reading and writing that came out of the experiments in the future of reading stuff. So, and all that stuff went away because, as was likely to happen, all 8 of us at Park got laid off and we were turned out onto the economy, which is why I'm back in academia. Excellent. Because I love it, because I have tenure again and I can pay my bills. And I did the startup for a while to try to get clients to pay for research, and that's a really brutal path. So now I'm trying a different paradigm of getting people to pay for research. But I think there's some really important insights. We've got all the technology that we developed at Xerox PARC, we have in perpetuity licenses for. That was one of the things we negotiated. So here I have this portfolio of technological devices that could be interesting. Not the only things, but they were very provocative and evocative. Second thing, the open educational resource movement. It is going full steam, and it has now become an international effort. We got to figure out a way in which to understand what a digital learning object is that will circulate in these open educational resource networks. Okay, we're wrestling with that. We kind of have some sense that uploading 100 physics syllabi, physics 101 syllabi, does not necessarily mean we have 100 learning objects. So we got to figure that out. I don't know what that means. I just know that's an issue on the table. There is a sense when we're trying to look kind of in the future and thinking Moore's Law and thinking where we're imagining the horizon of actual technological interfaces and so on, mixed reality learning environments, these are things that are going to be body-based, gesture-based. The Wii is just the beginning of that. Now we're, you know, we're starting to look at in 5 years, Oblong Systems imagines that the gesture-based interface that they produced in concept form, with, you know, faked it up for Minority Report, in 5 years that will be at a price point where it will be commercially available for libraries and museums. So we're imagining what happens when gesture-based interfaces and our walls become modulatable because of sensor, the increased development of sensor technology and so on. Then another thing that again is very kind of close to my heart, it's part of my polemic, is there is another parallel cultural movement that we need to kind of grab the energy of, and that is the DIY movement or the makers culture movement and so on. There is something very provocative and very important about making things with your hands and thinking through and with objects that is lost when we only engage with virtual and digital environments. So another part of this is to imagine how and where are we going to continue to teach kids how to think with objects. This also has to do with a polemic I have about the way in which the logic of the digital divide could reverse itself so that the only the disadvantaged, the economically disadvantaged get the virtual, and that the economically privileged get access to me and the material things, where I show them how to sew, how to solder, and how to make things, whereas the virtual becomes only simulations of things that used to be done with our hands. Okay, so what does this add up to? Well, it adds up to the future of libraries and museums. Yeah, exactly. Boy, that's it. So I take this project as an example of designing culture. These are our two historically, absolutely critically important cultural institutions for both the preservation of culture and the performance and staging of culture for the purposes of bringing new participants into culture, into cultural understandings. There's all kinds of related issues like the futures of the past, like how much history are we losing every day? Where does that go and whose responsibility is that? And that's about as far as I've gotten. So the question I have on the table is, what have you guys been thinking about in terms of the future of museums and libraries? And is there anything that strikes a chord in terms of what you might be interested in working on or getting involved in? So.
As somebody who's at the School of Information and Library Science, one of the key questions that we are dealing with is what is the future of designing librarians? And not just librarians as accredited librarians, but acknowledging that future of libraries as institutions and as intermediaries is going to include a lot more people who are practitioners in various degrees of information design access or not graduates of library programs. I mean, you already see that as a result of funding cutbacks that you just can't afford full-time library professionals, and so you have, of necessity, a lot more paraprofessionals. So, how do you then design the professionals that you do have to adapt to those circumstances and to whatever libraries are becoming? And so, I have no simple answers there, but I think, thinking about those spaces. Both physically and conceptually, the human element of the people who are going to be in those spaces and manning those spaces is really critical, I think.
I mean, so thinking of them, absolutely on target. They are information designers. Every time they come up with cloud tags and, you know, metadata and so on, I mean, both, we need the standard of metadata, but we also need people to understand kind of how the information that goes on top of the information, you know, also has a narrative and also has cultural effectivity, so that when we actually get to that moment of the semantic web, that web can't be stupid. I mean, that our semantics are full of, you know.
That's a that's a date that keeps receding into the distance down the road.
I know it, but it's the vision of the future that animates a lot of imaginations right now. And so I keep needing to engage in it because I need to know what are they thinking so that I can work backwards. It's backcasting, right? What are they thinking and where are we already on down that road? So the development of meta tags couldn't be a more obvious thing because that's the way the semantic web is going to organize itself. So we need to know, and where is the review? How do I do a close reading? This is a question I ask my humanist colleagues. How do I do a close reading of meta tags to analyze what narratives are being put into circulation and literally hard-coded into our information?
Fish and I got a small grant from Annenberg Network Culture earlier this year to do a piece of art for the part of the celebration for the opening of the Justice Center in Second Life. And we created essentially a small museum that could not have been created in real life, which was entirely composed, I composed all the textual material. The framework was created by Fish and the basic design, but all of the images that we used were Creative Commons attribution only off of Flickr. Mm-hmm. And the upper part of the display was, people. See, now I'm not, like, I'm
totally,
forgetting
I'm
which...
I'm totally there. Okay, you walk inside of this sphere, and once you walk into it, the world around you just disappears. And you're inside of this space that's nothing but social, well, global injustices.
But what
and
is
it's
the
imagery,
top
the top part is, you're actually in the global injustices that are going on. And you look below, at the barbed wire,
you're standing on a barbed wire floor. Mm-hmm.
And you look down, and you can see all the activists fighting for change.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the way that this was put, and the outside image was one image, which was the statue from the Supreme Court of Liberty Contemplating Justice. So we looked at this, and the way that you could experience this, because it was digital, was you never had to read the text. So if you just wanted to go in and use it as a space for contemplation, you could do that. But if you clicked on each image, it would give you the author's information, an explanation of the what the image was, and then a question that went with it. Mm-hmm. And so this is basically, you know, in something that you can conceive of as being, what, a 40-meter ball?
It was a 40-meter sphere, yeah.
40-meter sphere. We created a small museum having to do with issues of global justice in the course of 2 weeks in a way that it could never have been built in real life if we had the same intention.
So do you think that that the future of museums... Like, how heavily should we go or think about the virtual affordances of these environments for a kind of whole new track of museum construction?
Well, I can tell you that I believe, at least, a lot of people who saw the piece believe that it was far more evocative than reading the same thing in text, right? That you know, you walked into the space and you went whoosh. You know, the sort of the virtual, if you had air in the lungs of your avatar, it would go out, you know. And so I think that there is so much to be said for walking into the Buddha room at the MFA and having that same reaction, which you're not going to get from three-dimensional images of sacred statues. You know, there is an environment and atmosphere that you can create in the presence of actual artifacts, but there is a juxtaposition of ideas which you can't create on the pages of a book, or even on a web page, that you can create in three-dimensional spaces. That people, because people are using the metaphor in their minds of navigation, that they are there. There's something different that you can do, and because of the mechanisms like hiding text if you want to, and having these meta messages, like, you know, every image in there was from a person, not from a, you know, some of them were journalists, but they all released it to the commons. And so there were meta messages inherent in the work, which again could be in a book, but probably wouldn't. But you know, it's still there's still experiential. We need to preserve a whole bandwidth, a whole range of experiences.
Several threads David Weinberger have woven through work of yours. Do you want to jump in here and then we'll go to the back row?
I'm feeling a little overwhelmed. That was wonderful. I want to back up, though, because I am actually feeling a little overwhelmed. What assumptions, or maybe that's not the right word, but what assumptions as you think about the future of libraries, do you make about the future of physical books, which involves obviously assumptions also about reading devices, which right. you've been looking at for a long time. So when you're what do you think is going to happen with I'll say a little bit more. What do you think is going to happen with books? Because if one assumes right. that, except for special collections, where libraries are actually sort of book museums, right. that our access will be digital, then I'm not sure of the ways in which a digital library is a library at all. Mm-hmm. So what's your working assumption about where we're going with paper and that sort of thing?
Mm-hmm. My working assumption is that paper-based books are not going to disappear of a certain sort. The kind of paper-based books that are produced every year that have to do with data keeping and government records and so on, there's many genres of paper-based books, bound books that occupy library spaces that I think are going to migrate to the digital. That could very well be, exactly. I haven't really, but yes. And then there's other genres of paper-based books that I think aren't going to disappear because the book as an index is the only thing we've got. We don't have deep meta indexes. So for example, my book, when I think about the future of my book, the print-based version of my book will far outlast any of my digital artifacts. Far outlast. It'll outlast me. It will live beyond my lifetime. That's what I believe about the academic book, because it doesn't belong and it can't, it doesn't, it, it's not a part of case record, it's not a part of case history, it doesn't get cross-indexed in a way. So the answer is a little mixed in that I think some genres are going to be entirely digital, and then we have that problem of maintaining the accessibility of the digital archive. And then other paper-based books, I think, are going to persist because there is there's a set of affordances that paper allows that doesn't, you know, for the three people who are going to read my book in a decade from now, say, it doesn't pay off to digitize it in the way that it might, the case law that everything we rely on. So I think there's these economies that are going to come into play here. It'll be cheaper to keep the paper-based book than to digitize it.
This is I'm sorry to stay on sort of the uninteresting point, which is but I will for a moment. But
to your point about some libraries becoming museums of books, I think that's exactly a construct that's going to become more and more viable or more and more accepted, that this library will have this collection of books and this library will have this collection of physical books.
So, I mean, there's a common wisdom that because you produced your book electronically, in fact, the economics say that there won't be a paper.
That's right.
But right, we don't have readers now, so that electronic reader, so of course, paper. But at some point, well, this is one of the perpetual 5 years away things. You know, it has been for 20 years and more. We'll have electronic readers, and then the economics say, no, we won't print your book. We'll just go straight to electronics, which will have virtually all of the affordances except for smell and paper cuts. At which point the role of the library, if that were to happen, but say that's a sort of factual prediction that may be totally wrong, but that is obviously essential to planning for future libraries. So that's why I'm stuck on
it. It is essential to future libraries also in another way, because if we think about the cultural role that libraries play, which is beyond just being an archive of paper-based artifacts, it is a place, and you know, I've been focusing up till now mostly on community-based libraries. So it's a place where a community can perform its identity, or a member can participate in the performance of the identity as a community member. And so it's a stage, right, as much as it is a repository of archives, of artifacts. There are other things, and this is where we get into the tinkering and the making and stuff, that there may be a way in which community-based libraries in the future house and are museums of certain paper-based books that have relevance or importance to a community in a certain way, become a way station for things a community wants to have. So because understanding that books circulate also, that this may be a way station where we're perpetually circulating, but they're in residence right now there. Toy lending libraries and tool lending libraries are also two library paradigms that we might want to revisit for the things that are slipping away in a digital age. Educational instrumented sensor-based toys that are now kind of becoming a big commodity, industry and so on. It might be that the holdings of a community-based physical brick-and-mortar library expand beyond just books, as they have now with DVDs and CDs, to include educational toys. Now, I'm not endorsing all the ones that are commercially available. In fact, we're doing a kind of a kind of deep reading of some of those, because there may be some that are actually really good, you know, interactive globes and so on, that every library should have. And then there's a question about tools, tool lending libraries, video cameras, scanners, color printers, 3D printers, I don't know, you know, whatever it might be that, it might be soldering irons and laser cutters and vices and pliers and screwdrivers and, you know, the full range, and sewing machines and kilns. And there may be a possibility that the community library brick and mortar thing turns into something that is not just only about books as a mode and a capture of expression, but other ways in which culture is being made, and then we want the community to participate in culture in their community local groups.
So.
About academic departments in the humanities, where the emphasis is still on publishing in paper journals, and I'm, you know, getting my education in one of these departments, which is great, but how do you see them fitting into
I am really encouraged by some new efforts that are going on to rethink new modes of scholarly publication. Or to imagine new modes of scholarly, not even rethink. So I'm not going to take on all the humanities departments in the United States to argue that they should abandon measures of success based on print-based publications, because that's a project for somebody who's much more heroic than I am. So I kind of put my emphasis on being a fan of the efforts that are trying to think about new modalities of scholarly publication. There's a multimodal journal called Vectors that is peer-reviewed, does the whole nine yards of going through the steps that one would take to vet a piece of scholarship of work. And it is only published and can only be published online, because every article invents a new modality of reading. So you couldn't dump it into a print-based form. You have to learn, and this is where I ask my humanist colleagues, I know Vector's articles don't look familiar and you don't know where the knowledge is. You get an abstract and then you're dumped into, you know, a map of ephemera that's on the work practices of the secretarial kind of class in the 1950s and so on. I know that it doesn't look familiar, but you have to give yourself over to learning how to read again. And the way we learn to read these often is by somebody standing up and doing a performative reading of a Vector's article, so that people get their blood pressures lowered when confronted with a new reading modality. So I support that. The Mellon Foundation has a new project called Bamboo that's Berkeley and University of Chicago, and they're really taking on this issue of scholarly publishing, not just in the humanities, but they're starting kind of in the humanities. Really trying to imagine what's a new paradigm for kind of thinking about the whole peer review process. But of course, it's not just we write in in a digital environment so that we're, you know, we're authoring in a digital environment, we disseminate, we turn it into our publishers in a digital environment, or we submit to a journal in a digital environment, and so on. Behind the just the mechanics of getting your work out, disseminated, reviewed, peer-reviewed, and so on, which all is already happening digitally and so on, are the other institutional practices that are much more difficult. Getting on the tenure cases, making sure I chair tenure cases for those who have done digital scholarship, making sure that I get the letter writers for the people who are doing digital scholarship who can translate for the university-wide tenure committees the way in which this piece of digital scholarship is and was peer-reviewed. Here's the people who peer-reviewed them. They are as stellar as anyone else. So the other institutional changes that have to go on are nothing about what's going on digitally, and everything that goes that has to do with getting on the right committees, making the arguments to the upper administration, modeling good behavior in terms of writing tenure letters for people who are doing digital publishing. Those institutional practices are also part of what it means to develop new technologies that are appropriately meaningful and able to are part of this paradigm shift. Yeah.
Speaking around an issue that Dave was getting close to, and I know that Anne Catherine Hales has talked about in her book, Electronic Literature, which is that printing a book seems to be just an output form. And we're talking a lot about like outputs, publications, but I was wondering if you could talk for a moment about crafting in a digital environment. So, as David pointed out, we assume that you wrote your book, on a computer, word processor. So what kind of mechanics get ingrained that is a digital, signature of the digital,
yes,
within any print-based output
now? Absolutely critical. And this becomes, these are the kinds of questions that if you're doing a close reading of an electronic text, you must take into consideration.
These are not typical questions that print-based close readers, because they had so naturalized the print medium, they thought they knew what it took to write a book. I delve into this most really deeply in the chapter called Writing the Reading on the Wall, which is, I wrote a history, 36 episodes that covered 25,000 years of the history of reading, writing, and communication forms. I wrote it first in Word, and then I was writing it for a display where we hung a monitor, one of those, in portrait form. We hung a monitor on a wall, and you read the episodes by moving the monitor along the wall. And the place of the monitor was cued to the back timeline. So when you got to the era of Gutenberg, you'd get the Gutenberg story, right? So 36 episodes. Writing that history for display on that monitor involved all sorts of compromises, design decisions, and authoring decisions. For example, I had to go out of Word into Photoshop, out of Photoshop into an Alphamania plugin that treated the text, onto the screen, into Director, parsed through XML, onto the screen to then see how many of my precious words that I, as an academic, can proliferate, how many of my precious words would actually fit on a screen given the resolution of the screen. So what happened was then I started authoring backwards. So I knew the story that I wanted to tell. It was I was trying to avoid technological determinism, so I was trying to complicate the myth of the Gutenberg Revolution and so on and so forth. But then it was going backwards, almost writing history, haiku history, and not because of what was available to me in my Word document, or even in Photoshop I could have done a lot, but because the display convention or the display constraints of the screen just meant I was limited to 12 words a line at a certain point size. Okay, so that was a way in which I had to work backwards. So someone would say, wow, she was writing this for six-year-olds because, the language had to get simple and so on. But, I mean, maybe not six-year-olds, it was actually 12-year-olds because that's the demographic of the museum. But there was a way in which there were deep authoring decisions that had to be made every time I was condensing. So here's the thing. I wanted to refuse submerged narratives of technological determinism. So every time I had to translate a kind of process into a verb, I had to think about who's the agent of the verb am I making the technology or the device the agent of the verb? I mean, those are authoring. I mean, those are theoretical authoring decisions that were not, that weren't even me kind of creatively kind of coming up with this. This was imposed by my interactions authoring with that device, because I only had a certain number of pixels to use for the words. Now, wherein, and I talk about this in the chapter, wherein the other authoring conventions kind of come forward from the book is I knew that the literacy that I could expect people to come to the museum with to apprehend this, it had to make sense to them. I couldn't just start putting words and images up and so on. So I ended up borrowing the conventions of page, what Jerry McGann calls page space. You know, we all, we as page book-based readers have very deep conventions about what the hierarchy of information is on the top of a page, on the bottom of the page. When font sizes change, we know the conventions of how to apprehend meaning. So I used page-based conventions of point size and location on the screen to help bridge from the literacy of the book to the literacy of the screen. They were seeing this thing for the first time. No one had seen this before. They didn't know how to read this thing. So it was exactly in that oscillation between knowing how to read and write for a book versus trying to read and write off of this thing, that that those designerly questions and became authoring questions. I mean, there was no demarcation between being a designer and being an author. Every design decision was, in fact, an author's decision. And as I got closer, every author's decision became a design decision. So those are critical questions.
Sort of jumping back towards the role of libraries, the role of museums, how that changes with digital information and digital environments. I'm thinking a lot about how libraries function as, because it is also a change in production and where the library becomes producer, and the library also becomes, to a certain extent, where objects are digital, a giver, as opposed to a lender in the digital world. And it's and the implications of being able to produce digital copies with zero cost of production through a library, through a community source, it changes the whole economics of the way that that culture percolates through society, and it also changes the role of the library. What role does redundancy have when you have two digital collections which might be buried somewhat, but will have massive overlap?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, in the context of a museum, the selection is. Creates the museum. It's you can't have everything. If you had all of ancient Greece in one room, it wouldn't function as a museum. You need to select certain objects and turn that into the exhibit. As insofar as libraries function as aggregators of all data possible, as like Library of Congress and the Harvard Library System and comparable libraries, I mean that almost becomes the divide between a book museum and a
mm-hmm.
library.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the question of redundancy and how,
mm-hmm.
how that affects the way that information travels
mm-hmm.
and is treated is my concern.
Good question. I don't know. I kind of think maybe museums need to be more like libraries of the past, and libraries need to be more like museums in the hands-on stuff that they do. 'Cause, you know, I'm thinking about the computer museum in the Bay Area that is, you know, has taken on the project of collecting the machines. And not very long ago, maybe 7 years ago, they remembered that they needed to collect the software that ran on the machines. And by that time, it was already going to be an impossible task. So the best they could do was come up with they would survey people for the top 100 pieces of software ever written. So there's a place where I think they're the only ones doing that. You know, do we need another? I mean, if they do it and they do it really well, then I don't know that we need it to be done everywhere else. It'll be really good that museum does that and serves as that cultural archive for this incredible, important set of artifacts. So partly, I guess, the question is, what do we need reproducible lots of places? What can we do in terms of connecting, like through these virtual museums, the real holdings that exist in one place, but we can get at them virtually. I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah. The thing to remember is that what libraries are doing is that they are providing access at all times through sort of the history of libraries, they provide access to whatever in a given time is a scarce knowledge resource. And so at a certain time, you know, books were scarce enough that you couldn't take them out, even with, you know, with special collections now. And as books became cheaper, you could take them out. The marginal cost of maintaining digital copies of information is low, but it is very much not zero. And you're not going to get any sort of a situation where you have any library, no matter how big, maintaining the, you know, gorgeous copy of every single library possible. There's always going to be decisions that have to be made about curation and collection development. Like you were saying, certain libraries or institutions or museums are going to have certain things and not others. And that's, you know, that is the role that going forward, both librarians and information designers and anybody who's involved in this process is, and curators are gonna have to make.
Oh, hey. Oh, not in the bad sense.
The tell.
In the good sense. The curation, the requirement for curation in almost all libraries, except for the couple that you mentioned, Library of Congress and law libraries, actually seems to me to have another role, which is to say that a canon is possible. It's possible mm-hmm. to have a place that has the good books, which means there is such a thing as the good books.
The good book, yeah.
And that creates, that's yeah. also a requirement for creating a history as well.
Yeah. Or at least the yeah. books for a population. These are the books that our patrons want/need. There are scarce resources, and it's a decision that needs to be made.
Well, certainly, but when one collection trumps all others, when you have, if the Library of Congress digitized everything, what role does the local library serve for most of the vast majority of their collections?
It's too big. They are.
To what extent is the funding of a server farm of the Library of Congress's collections any worse than the funding of the Library of Congress to begin with? Like, if the Library of Congress itself is imaginable, why can't the same thing in a server farm also be imaginable?
Well, they already can't keep up. I mean, you need to every year
run into the human factor.
Geometrically increase the funding and the staffing of Library of Congress to actually keep pace with its curation decisions need to be made. This isn't a bad thing.
All right, this is a live exchange. You can take it up. Adam Holland, too, in fact, was a medalist in your '96 Olympics.
All right.
Yeah. I'm going to try to bring the cross-platform humanism here. I studied folklore and mythology as an undergraduate, and I read more than anything else a great deal of science fiction. Great. So you probably read the quote then that science fiction is the mythology of the industrial age. Okay. I also read a lot of authors talking about their own writing, and a recurring theme I would say within the last, I'm going to say 8 years, but you know it couldn't be any more on either side of that, is that the future is becoming increasingly less susceptible to prediction of any kind. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, it used to be like, oh yeah, we can make realistic forecasts 40 years out, 50 years out, and then it was 30, and then it was 20. Mm-hmm. And there are some people saying you can't do it at all. Mm-hmm. That we're literally in too much of a ferment, mm-hmm. a generative state. Mm-hmm. With incipient technologies, with current technologies, mm-hmm. to even know with confidence what tomorrow is going to bring, mm-hmm. much less 5 years, 10 years, you know, whether it's fusion, it's 30 years away, or whether it's a digital library. And so I'm wondering to what extent your informing principle of you are designing culture mm-hmm. involves, and I mean mm-hmm. only just, I'm just going to say it, but yeah. almost a hubris. Mm-hmm. And that you have no idea. Mm-hmm. You know, I wish I'd said this, but I didn't. You know, the street finds its own uses for
yes,
things.
Yes, exactly. I know. Yeah.
And that yeah. it seems like maybe yeah. the role of your project. I loved it when you said you had 19 different what reading yeah. can become. I was like, oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Is that right. Maybe libraries should see themselves as not yeah. designing culture, not predicting culture,
yeah.
but providing as I'm trying to think of. as rich a growth medium for culture as possible, and then sort of step back and see what survives.
You raise such a great point for so many reasons. One is that I bet there are lots of science fiction books that you and I have read who would consider the most important books of ever that don't make it into the grand collections of our esteemed libraries because they're pulp fiction and they were meant to be read and discarded. So that's one about what counts as a good book. Second of all, the thing about designing culture it has an ethical dimension, not a predictive dimension. My point is not that I can design the culture we should have. My point is that anything I design will be inevitably the conditions on which culture gets produced in the future. It's kind of trying to remind people who are designing technologies that this becomes part of culture in the future. Are you thinking about what the implications are? And the imagination is not always, it's predictive in an unpredictable way. The technological imagination, this is that dynamic about you're always kind of imagining something, but your imagination is absolutely imperfect. You know, you're imagining based on only what you know now and your own values. I want this to, not that everything else is going to conspire to get your vision of the future enacted. Your imagination that you then use to design something or create something is your projection of a future, not a prediction, a projection, a phantasm of the future. And the thing is, it's always going to miss. That's what we know about science fiction, right? They missed a lot, wildly, and so on. But then there was ways in which those projections, so one of the parts of this project is called the imaginary 20th century. It's to go back to the history of science fiction, to trace the way in which we imagined the 20th and the 21st century in our expressive creative literature, see where those were never predictions. They were projections, and they were projections ethnographically based on what was going on at the time. Just like our projections now are not predictions. They are projections. And they have to do with our anxieties now, so that every work of technology development is a time-traveling exercise. We are addressing problems that we have insights into now that are going to have a life in the future, but we don't know how it's going to affect that life in the future. But it's not okay for me to say, I don't know how it's going to affect life in the future. I think at some point we need, during the process, to reflect on how it might affect life in the future, because it will be. And so that's the oscillation. It's not at all to predict the perfect library, the future. It's to start thinking about, okay, we're going to make changes. People are digitizing. People are moving to Second Life. People are doing this. People are doing that. Okay, what are the consequences? What are likely or unintended consequences? Can we imagine unintended consequences? Where is the limit? And how do we stretch our technological imagination to take into account some of these other things? Because you're right. It is absolutely not predictive. Prediction, and this is also something that science fiction predicted, which was the singularity. The singularity. We cannot predict anymore.
One last question.
Okay.
So clearly this
paradigm. Sorry, I get excited about
this. This paradigm shift is allowing us to do things that are unprecedented in arts and education. And I was just curious as to what you think might be lost or what the negatives might be of the huge change that society is undergoing right now.
The major one right now that I'm really lamenting about is I had a group of students in a course called The History of Literacy, and there was an ongoing question about why is it important to remember? And that disturbs me as a worldview. That disturbs me a lot, because they are just-in-time rememberers, just as they are just-in-time learners. They think when they need to know something, they can get it off the web, and that they're not really, I think we haven't taught this digital, born digital generation, and maybe they're too young to know the value of remembering. And because they leave traces of themselves, so remembering for them is a very different process than I think culturally remembering was for an earlier generation. So my biggest lament right now is I don't know how to convince them it's important to remember, which ties to why is history important, which ties to the thing about the futures of the past. And every day the web forgets more than it remembers, and things go 404, and I think that's problematic for a culture. But maybe that's the way cultures evolve, is repression and then willful forgetting and then erasure and eradication.
Anne Balsamo, I'm quite sure that this will not be forgotten anytime soon.
Thank you.
This was an instant classic in the Berkman Lunch series. I can tell from the many, many tips passed out in front of us and let us pull on. This was just a great tour. A couple of things that I will certainly remember. One is thinking about the digital divide the other way, thinking about the possibility that digital divide might be putting people who are on the wrong side of it for economic or other social reasons into the virtual only. And what a sort of a shame that would be if we work so hard to get to an integrated environment and then push it the other way. And the other is the extent to which this is a converged learning and cultural development environments, and that we need to have interdisciplinary places like the picture of your lab there. We very much hope the Berkman Center can be that in our field, but I look forward to figuring out how we might be part of your distributed network. So thank you for making the trip.
Thanks. Thank you.